From 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR, this is Lake Effect. I'm Joy Powers. Today we'll get some advice on how to vote in tomorrow's partisan primary election. Capital Notes will explore some of the biggest races in the election and the Republican National Convention that seems likely to come to the city. Then we'll learn about mindful drinking as more quality options for low and no proof drinks continue to grow.
The only thing that if you say I'm not doing it, you have to explain yourself for it. I'd like to see that change.
Plus, Bubbler Talk explores a small century-old road tucked away in Lake Park that's been closed off to public use.
This lovely winding road has been closed for so many years, and as I drive past it, I see all this equipment sitting there and a big fence, and nobody seems to be doing anything with it.
That is coming up on Lake Effect. But first, here are today's headlines. This is Lake Effect from 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. I'm Joy Powers, and thank you so much for joining us. Tomorrow is the partisan primary election here in Wisconsin. While many people have already voted, others will be headed to the polls to cast their vote for their preferred candidates for each race. For first-time voters, this process can be especially confusing, figuring out how to register and who will be on the ballot. Claire Woodall-Vogue is the executive director of the Milwaukee Election Commission, and she joins me now to share some of her tips on how to have a smooth election day experience. Claire, thank you so much for being here on Lake Effect.
Thanks so much for having me.
How can you find your polling place?
The best website to commit to memory is myvote.wi.gov. And this is the statewide website that anyone listening can use to check their voter registration. They can search by address to find their polling place. You can view what's going to be on your ballot and also find out who your clerk is in case you have questions and want to know what your early voting hours might be, or questions specific to your city.
Now, if you're either not registered to vote or you realize in looking it up that you are no longer registered to vote, what kind of documentation do you need to bring to your polling place? You can register there, right?
Yes, that's something that we get questions about a lot, is that we still have Election Day registration in Wisconsin. This is what contributes to us having one of the highest turnout rates in general elections. So you would go to your new polling place. You would want to look that up on MyVote based on your current address. And then you have to bring proof of your address. If your photo ID, like your Wisconsin driver's license or your state ID card, has that address, that's all you would need to bring with you. But your ID doesn't have to have your current address. Instead, you can bring a utility bill, a bank statement, a paycheck, a lease, anything from a government agency that has your name and your address. And you can either have the hard copy or you can show this on your phone. So we see a lot of voters, they might show up and they don't have exactly what they need, but lots of people now are able to pay their cell phone bills. They're able to pay their We Energies bill online. And you can pull up that information on your cell phone.
So you don't actually need the physical piece of mail. You can just bring it up through your email or via, I know, ID We Energies through an app.
Yep, that's exactly right. So you can show your proof of address for registering to vote on an app or on your phone. Now for photo ID, everyone has to show photo ID when they vote. That has to be the physical ID with you. So a driver's license or state ID from Wisconsin or passport are the most often used photo IDs.
All right. So if you are voting at a new location, possibly, or if you're just going out, do we know how long people can expect to wait in the city of Milwaukee at their polling place?
You know, the only good thing to come out of COVID, it seems, with voting is that a lot of voters are still choosing to vote absentee, either at early voting or by mail. So even during the presidential 2020 election, we didn't see any long lines. So I would say to budget, I always say at least 15 minutes from start to finish, even if you're registered to vote. Maybe make sure you have half an hour because you do have to fill out one piece of paperwork if you're registering. But we've had virtually no wait times, you know, maybe 5 minutes here or there. But our polling places have been running very efficiently. And a lot of that has to do with how many people have already voted when it comes to Election Day.
In general, what would you say is your biggest piece of advice for first-time voters?
My biggest piece of advice for first-time voters is to make a plan and plan ahead. You want to visit the MyVote website. You want to see if you're already registered. If not, you can go ahead and fill out a registration form and print it off and bring it with you if you want. It will have all of that proof of address information. And you can also see what races are going to be on your ballot. If you are like me and you're horrible with names, you can bring a sample ballot with you already filled in so that you remember who you want to vote for in each race. That is always allowed. And for me, I have to rely on it quite often for those races where I might have just researched right beforehand and decided who I wanted to vote for. But the most important thing is to find your polling place and to know if you're already registered or not so you know how much time to allow on Election Day.
All right, well, Claire, thank you so much for joining us here on Lake Effect, and good luck with the election.
Thank you so much.
Claire Woodall-Vogue is the executive director of the Milwaukee Election Commission. If you're still holding on to an absentee ballot, do not drop it in the mailbox. You can still hand it in at an early voting location or at the Milwaukee Election Commission. For more information on absentee voting, you can head to wuwm.com and check out our earlier conversation with Woodall-Vogue from last week.
From Milwaukee's NPR, this is Capital Notes. We break down the big political news affecting Wisconsin. I'm Mayan Silver. It's a day before the primary election, so we're speaking with J.R. Ross, editor of WisPolitics.com, about what you need to know in key races this midterm election year. Here's our conversation. Hi, J.R. Welcome back.
Hey, how are you doing today?
Pretty good. So, you know, what we've got main U.S. Senate candidates dropping out of that race. Just to remind people, Tom Nelson, Alex Lazry, and Sarah Godlewski are still on the ballot, but they have dropped out of the race. So it looks like Lieutenant Governor Mandela Barnes will potentially coast to victory. Is there anything important that we need to know about that race? Any benchmarkers that Barnes is looking for in terms of turnout?
You know, it was going to be interesting if we had still a contested primary on the Democratic side and one on the Republican side for governor to compare turnout, right? Because there are all these questions about enthusiasm and who has it. And in the post-U.S. Supreme Court decision in the Dobbs case overturning the right to an abortion nationally, really interesting to see if Democrats were jazzed up more than were before. But we're not going to have that now. Yes, there are some other candidates on the ballot against Mandela Barnes. Yes, Nelson, Lazary, Galuski remain on the ballot, but that one's pretty much over. I don't think there's going to be a huge groundswell of turnout for Democrats. Now, there really isn't a reason to right now on that side, unless you're really passionate about the Secretary of State's race and that primary over there. There's not much to drive people out. So I don't think they're looking for any benchmarks as much as they have a head start now on focusing on Ron Johnson. Granted, all the Democrats running were kind of focusing on Johnson, a lot of their criticisms, but this really made it a one-on-one race for Mandela Barnes 2 weeks earlier than it could have been if there had been a contested primary.
And you mentioned that Secretary of State race. Some Republicans want to shift oversight of elections from the bipartisan Wisconsin Elections Commission to the elected Secretary of State's office. The WEC was itself created by Republicans in 2016 instead of the more independent Government Accountability Board, over which politicians had little influence. What should people know about this year's Secretary of State race?
Well, a couple of things. One, Doug La Follette has been Secretary of State since 1975 for all but 4 years of that period. He spent $86, that's right, $86, on his pre-primary report. So he wasn't really doing a whole lot. He told me that he was running mostly a virtual campaign, relying on Zoom calls and social media. He faces Alexia Saber, who is the chair of the Dane County Democratic Party. Now, she faced the challenge of, one, he has kind of a golden name in Wisconsin politics, and two, she didn't raise enough money to effectively communicate to a statewide audience about why she thinks he should lose. So really a challenge there for her to beat the Follett because of resources and his name. On the Republican side, what's interesting is Amy Loudenbeck, who is a state lawmaker, member of the Joint Finance Committee, really kind of has the establishment support in that primary. She faces Jay Schrader, who is from Neenah, ran against La Follett 4 years ago. Schrader has been pushing the idea that if he had been Secretary of State in 2020, he would not have certified the results for Joe Biden. Now, I'm not sure exactly how he could have stopped that from happening, but he's argued that that would be something he would have done. There is a PAC that is not really registered with the state of Wisconsin that trying to figure out who they are, but they've been doing mailers saying that Jay would try and make it harder to cheat while Amy would make it easier to cheat. I don't know that the mailer is necessarily accurate, but it is an attack going after Amy Loudenbeck, who's normally a sleepy race where she has all the establishment support and has had a financial edge. Schrader did put about $86,000 of own money into the race, the very end of it. So he's going for broke here at the end. But really, primaries like these are so far down the ballot for people compared to the governor's race or the Senate race. They're not really paying as much attention to them. It'll be fascinating to see what the turnout is and the results, especially in that GOP primary where you have somebody pushing this whole kind of stop the steal notion against Amy, who's, you know, called for election integrity measures, but more kind of an establishment pick type Republican.
I see. So that's something to watch along with going forward, whether or not the GOP-led legislature and whoever's in the governorship would pass power over elections going to the Secretary of State's office, right?
Yeah, I mean, you know, Tim Michaels, Rebecca Clayfish, they've called for abolishing the Elections Commission. Obviously, if Governor Evers is reelected, he's not going to allow it to happen. But Robin Voss, the Assembly Speaker, he's not in favor of abolishing WEC. He wants to see changes made, but he's not talking about doing away with it and returning those powers to the Secretary of State's office. So it is, I'm not sure how much momentum the whole push to put elected officials back in charge of elections will have, regardless of what happens in November or who's governor. But because of the legislature, I mean, both, I think, Robin, I think Devin Lemahieu as well, the Senate Majority Leader, also says he's not in favor of abolishing that agency. So I think Republicans would make a lot of changes to state law about elections, but I'm not sure they're ready to abolish the agency.
I see. Okay. So flipping over to the GOP primary for governor, both former Vice President Mike Pence and former President Donald Trump were in Wisconsin stumping for their respective candidates. That was frontrunners Rebecca Clayfish, who is aligned with Pence, and Tim Michaels, who is aligned with Trump. The Journal Sentinel called it the big surrogate struggle. Is that race still neck and neck, and did either of those visits push the needle?
Well, we saw a poll that came out from Emerson College on Saturday or Sunday. Had it neck and neck. I think it was like within 2 points with Clayfish, you know, a slight edge, but within the margin of error, so not really, you know, a lead on Michaels. I don't know that Mike Pence by himself visiting is going to sway that election. Now, Trump is a different political animal in terms of like what he can do. He's much more prominent in campaigns. That Emerson poll showed that a lot of Republicans are decent numbers that are more likely to support somebody if Trump supports them. However, half of it makes no difference. So I don't know how big a deal even Trump's endorsement is. Really, it's about the arguments that Clayfish and Michaels have made and the cases they've made to voters. It's been interesting to see what's happened in the last closing weeks. Sometime in like early July, it really looked like Michaels is in strong position. He had kind of had a blitz of early ads. Clayfish was kind of struggling. There was a feeling that, you know, things are really kind of moving Michaels' direction. And then she started going negative on him. And there was kind of a little bit of a political antenna popped up for people about her doing that, wondering, okay, does this mean she's trailing? Is she falling way behind? Is she desperate? Whatever, you know, angle you want to take on that. Whatever it was that motivated it, doing it probably helped. There's definitely a sense that she has gotten her legs under her and has pulled even with Michael. August polling is always kind of a little challenging to get right. Either way, both sides are going negative at the end. Michaels has got ads hitting Clayfish on China. Club for Growth Action is doing ads against Clayfish. You have Clayfish going after Michaels. You have a group backing Clayfish going after Michaels. There's a lot of stuff flying around right now. And I'm wondering, what do voters go for? Do they want the experience of Clayfish, or do they want an outsider in Michaels, somebody who hasn't been in government for a good chunk of his life? And what are they going to pick on Tuesday?
I'm going to pose something to you which may be very difficult to answer and probably potentially impossible to answer, but which candidate, Clay Fisher-Michaels, is considered, you know, to be the stronger adversary against incumbent Democratic Governor Tony Evers?
Oh, I've been asking that question for weeks, and I've gotten different answers because each could pull a different segment of the coalition that Evers could put together to win. So Clay Fish, for example, she may be able to do better with female voters who, you know, Evers wants to do well with. She might be able to pull that coalition. Also, a little less Trumpy. So might those suburban college-educated women in Waukesha County, for example, be more likely to go with Clay Fish than Michaels, who fully embraced Trump, who turned off those very voters we're talking about? Michaels, though, has the advantage that he is an outsider. We're in an environment people aren't happy. They're angry about things. They want change. They don't like incumbents. If you're Michaels is the opponent, he is a true, you know, non-incumbent. Didn't spend 8 years as lieutenant governor. He would offer more of an attraction that way. So there's pluses and minuses to either of them. Either way, what I'm watching is how much cash they have left when they get out through this primary and who comes in to help them right after, because Clay Fish especially is probably going to be broke right after the primary is over. Are you going to see the Republican Governors Association come in and spend a bunch of money to kind of give her some time, air cover? Because I can bet you money, whoever wins the primary on Tuesday, that you will start to see ads from somebody going after them not long after that. They want to define, Democrats do want to define either Michaels or Clay Fish for voters before they can do it on their own. You know, they're going to hit them on things like abortion. Both have embraced Wisconsin's 1849 ban on abortion, except to save life of the mother. They are going to hit them on that issue from now until November, most likely. You're going to see things like that start to pop up. And that's going to be interesting to watch. You know, what do they have left in the tank to respond to that? And who helps them respond to those attacks that are coming any day now?
You're listening to Capital Notes. I'm WUWM's Mayan Silver, speaking with J.R. Ross, editor at WisPolitics.com. So, J.R., that sort of leads into tomorrow's primary election. It's a partisan primary, so you can vote for either the Democratic races or the Republican races, or there's also Libertarian and Constitution Party write-ins, but you can't mix and match. It all comes on one ballot. Do Democrats ever vote in the Republican primary and vice versa for strategic reasons? And would you expect any of that tomorrow? And if so, why?
Sure. I mean, you hear anecdotally stuff, people talking about doing that. The challenge is, in all my years of covering this, it's hard to point to examples where there was a concerted effort to get one party or the other to vote in the other's primary and really made a difference. Again, there are anecdotal information or stories about it happening, but I don't know you can say this one really swung a race because X party played in Y party's primary. Remember, you get one ballot, you have to check if you want to vote for the Republican primary, Democratic, or whatnot. You only vote in those. You can't vote, for example, in the primary for Secretary of State on the Democrats and the Republican governor's primary. Can't do that. But no, I don't know that I'm going to see a big groundswell of people doing stuff. But for Democrats, with there being no more Senate primary, you can go kind of mess around the Republican primary if you wanted to and not have it hurt your party. Now, Ozzie Doug La Follette and Alexia, they'd love to have you vote in the primary because they want your vote for Secretary of State. But it is interesting to see what will Democrats do tomorrow because they don't have a real big high profile race on their ticket right now.
So besides the governor and U.S. Senate, there are other races on the ballot, like the attorney general's race. Incumbent Democrat Josh Call is running again, and he's challenged, you know, through his tenure, he's challenged state and federal laws in line with Democrats, issues like the environment, LGBTQ rights. And he has said his DOJ will not prosecute doctors for performing abortions in Wisconsin. Who's running in the Republican primary to challenge him, and can you tell us about them?
The two most high-profile candidates are Eric Toney, the Finelette County district attorney, and Adam Jarko, a former state lawmaker from Balsam Lake. What's been interesting there is Jarko has no experience as a prosecutor. And Republicans kind of like having experience as prosecutor. Voters in general like you having prosecutorial experience if you're going to become attorney general. That's one reason why people tell me Eric Toney has done well in votes like at state convention back in May with the endorsement vote for the party. Now, he fell shorter than Mark needed to get the party's endorsement, but he did do much better than Jarko. It underscores that when Toney has the opportunity, when he can connect with voters or talk to them, he connects with them quite well. The challenge for Toney has been he does not have the resources to connect enough. Jarko has outraised Toney. Looking at the latest reports of the state for independent expenditures, those are those express advocacy ads saying like vote for, vote against, support, you know, the magic words you call them in politics. There's been nearly $1 million spent to support Adam Jarko through ads, mail, canvassing. That's a huge advantage in this. What gives Republicans pause when I talk to them is normally they'd say, okay, that person has all the financial advantages. They should win. They're given pause because of what they've seen these caucus votes. They're kind of going, why is Jarko not connecting with people the way maybe they think he should? It could be that experience thing. So it'll be fascinating to see. I think talking to Republicans, they feel like Jarko should have the edge on Tuesday, but they're not going to be surprised if Tony pulls it out just because he has that experience that Jarko does not.
And there are 9 primary challenges to incumbent GOP state lawmakers around the state, including longtime Republican Assembly Leader Robin Voss. Why is this important?
Well, one, it kind of is a test of this kind of establishment Republican candidate versus these upstarts who are making claims about the 2020 election. The Adam Steen challenge, Robin Voss, is a prime example of that. Steen has claimed the election was stolen. He's endorsed by Donald Trump, who, you know, did that rally on Friday for Tim Michaels, but also had Steen come speak, praise Steen from the stage. Michael Gableman, who Voss basically hired to do a review of the 2020 election, he's endorsing Steen. Steen is all about 2020, saying that the election was stolen. Robin Voss has said, look, I have concerns about fraud in that election, but we can't go back. Lawyers have told us repeatedly, you cannot overturn the election results. Let's not focus on that anymore. So it's going to be a real contest of establishment versus that kind of thing. And oh, by the way, looking at those independent expenditure reports, there's been like about $150,000 spent on Robin's behalf, either pro-Voss material or anti-Steen. About $30,000 spent for Steen. You know, that's a disparity there. I've, you know, been told that Capitol lawmakers have gone down to Robin's district and done doors. Lobbyists have gone down there and volunteered their time. You know, staff have put time in on their time off to go do it. I mean, they are not taking this lightly because they don't want Robin Voss in the Eric Cantor of Wisconsin. Remember, Cantor was the powerful Republican House leader who lost, surprisingly, his primary out in Virginia a few years back. They are not taking this lightly. They are going and working to protect Voss. Again, it's a question of, can the Trump endorsement help somebody so much who has really not much else going for him to make a difference?
Okay, so I'd also like to touch on the lieutenant governor races. There are primaries for Democrats and Republicans. Lieutenant governors don't usually garner much attention, and their sole responsibility is to step in and lead the state if the governor becomes incapacitated. But clearly, it's not like a U.S. president who picks their vice president. Can you tell us about how they work together and the candidates in each primary?
So the candidates run separately on the ballot. They both have primaries. Once the primaries are over, they're on the ticket. So on the Republican side, for example, the top two candidates, Roger Roth and Pat Teston, both state lawmakers, those are the ones who spent the most, raised the most. Let's say one of them gets through that primary and advances. He will run with whomever voters choose in that Republican primary. So it'll be Tim Michaels or Rebecca Clayfish, the top of the ticket, with, you know, either Roth or Teston as one ballot line, right? In that Republican primary, Roth spent about $300,000 in the pre-primary period, which is mostly July. Teston spent about $34,000. I mean, that's a huge disparity. It's not overwhelming, but it's significant when you're talking about going for a statewide audience. You know, Roth has spent money on TV, the Milwaukee and Green Bay markets. He's got a group doing mail for him, I think radio as well. Those things help. On the Democratic side, Sarah Rodriguez is a freshman state lawmaker from Brookfield. She decided to run for lieutenant governor rather than seek re-election to her seat, which became way more Republican of the new maps. She's running against Peng He, which is a guy in Madison, a CEO of the Hmong Institute, I believe it's called. Sarah has an advantage. She's raised a little bit more money, spent a little bit more, done some digital ads, a little more out there, but better known because she's studying lawmaker. So I think she has an edge, but that one's been pretty quiet. So it's going to be interesting to watch how those two turn out.
All right. Well, looking forward to checking in next week to talk about the results. JR, thanks for joining me on Capitol Notes.
Anytime.
That was J.R. Ross of WisPolitics.com speaking with me, WUWM's Maayan Silver. Listen for our segments every Monday with an extended segment on Lake Effect. And check out the Capitol Notes podcast wherever you get your podcasts.
roads can hold a special meaning for some people. In about 15 minutes, Bubbler Talk explores one such road that's been winding its way through Milwaukee's east side for more than a century. But first, what is a shrub? Well, the kind we're going to learn about isn't the plant that you're thinking of, but an alcohol replacement.
Historically, they were used as a method of preservation. So when the season's bounty appeared and it was starting to spoil, people would add vinegar and sugar and make delicious syrups for the public houses or to hydrate the farmers in the fields.
We'll learn about locally made siren shrub and about the concept of mindful drinking next on Lake Effect on 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. You're listening to Lake Effect on 89.7 WUWM. I'm Joy Powers. According to this year's Bacardi Cocktail Trends Report, more than half of global consumers are drinking more non-alcoholic and low ABV drinks than last year. This implies the supposed trend of low and no-proof drinks is here to stay far beyond dry January. Even here in the brewing state, there are many local products on the market to give people more options outside of alcoholic drinks, some of which we've talked about on Lake Effect. This move away from alcohol as the default drink option is also called the Mindful Drinking Movement. And tonight, there'll be a Drink Mindful Milwaukee event highlighting sophisticated, no and low-proof drinks. Mindy McCord, the co-founder of Wisconsin-based Siren Shrub Company, will be a part of it, along with Derek Brown, an award-winning bartender and author of Mindful Mixology. They both join Lake Effect's Audrey Nowakowski to share more about why they believe mindful drinking is here to stay.
So this question is for the both of you. What does mindful drinking mean to you?
So I think that mindful drinking, for me, it's pretty clear cut. It means that you're aware of the reasons why you drink. So, you know, for most people, they have a good reason to drink. They know what they're going to drink and how much they're going to drink. For some people, that feels a little different. And sometimes because of things like stress or anxiety or even peer pressure, they might feel obligated to have additional drinks or feel compelled in some way. So I think mindful drinking really is about taking a pause, realizing that you have options. It's not just about drinking alcohol. You can have no alcohol cocktails. You can have low alcohol cocktails. You can choose something completely different. So it's not just about that why, but it's also about choice, realizing that you have so many options. And more than ever, bars, restaurants are starting to adopt these programs that have no and low alcohol cocktails. So, you know, I think mindful drinking leads to mindful mixology in a way.
And for you, Mindy?
Yeah, I think for Siren Shrub Co., it's very similar to what Derek had to say. It's about taking the habitualness out of it and realizing that there's options to still have a ritualistic experience with your cocktails, with or without alcohol. And for us, it's truly all about providing that option.
Mindy, you're the co-founder of Siren Shrub Company here in Wisconsin. So for everyone wondering, listening right now, what is a shrub and what's its history?
That's a fabulous question. What is a shrub? So a shrub is a drink from the 1800s. For us, it's three ingredients. It's organic apple cider vinegar, organic cane sugar or maple syrup, and then a fruit, root, or herb. There's a process where there's a marriage between the sugar and the fruits that draw out those juices. There's a fermentation period, and then we add the apple cider vinegar into that mixture to make a syrup. You use that syrup a splash at a time in cocktails, non-alcoholic drinks. You can put it in sparkling water. People also cook with them, so they're super versatile and fun. Historically, they were used as a method of preservation. So when the season's bounty appeared and it was starting to spoil, people would add vinegar and sugar and make delicious syrups for the public houses or to hydrate the farmers in the fields.
So as you mentioned, it's a drink from the 1800s. So how did you learn about this and what was the inspiration to start Siren Shrub?
Yeah, so my co-founder, Lane Casalino, and I have always, our friendship developed in the kitchen. We're canners, fermenters at heart. We worked farmers markets for a long time, selling jams, jellies, relishes, things like that. When Lane became pregnant, she was looking for an alcohol alternative. And that's really when we started to explore the mindful drinking movement. So that was back in 2018, and realized that shrubs were a fantastic replacement for alcohol, and not a lot of people knew about them, at least here in Wisconsin. And so we started making them and sampling them out at farmers markets, and people freaked out. They loved them. They were super curious about them. We got really jazzed about it too, and decided we were just going to go full in. And so it developed out of a seeking of alcohol alternative. We wanted something complex and tasty that still felt grown up and interesting. And we found that in shrubs.
So Derek, you're a bartender, bar owner, cocktail and spirits expert. What misconceptions do you think people may have about low and no proof drinks or about mindful drinking itself?
Well, I think there's a couple things. First and foremost, I think people might think it's a trend. But it's actually, you know, it goes as far back as even the 19th century, since we're on that topic of history, where you had in many of the early bartender's guides, including the first bartender's guide, which is by Jerry Thomas in 1862, they have temperance drinks or they have non-alcoholic cocktails. And so not only that, the first mention of the cocktail in print is in London in 1798, and it mentions ginger, but it doesn't necessarily mention alcohol. And so there's some contention there, whether it had alcohol or didn't. So it's something that, you know, has been an option for a long time. And I guess it kind of disappeared, right? And so people, you'd walk into a bar and you'd say, I want a non-alcoholic drink for whatever reason, right? It could be because of health. It could be because of piety. It could be because you just have a meeting the next day. You don't, you know, you want something that goes easy. And so you'd ask the question, you get soda or lemonade, or if you're lucky, a Shirley Temple, you know? So I think that having those options is really important, but I think that the misconception being that it's something new. The second part of that is that somebody who chooses to not drink alcohol has a problem with it, right? So the fact is that there are definitely people who have trouble with alcohol, and for many reasons, they've decided that they can't drink it or they don't want to drink it. But there's also a lot of people who just want to cut back, or people who want something delicious. They want the ritual, as Mindy said earlier, but they don't necessarily want the alcohol. In a way, it's about choosing how they want to feel. And so I think that that's another sort of misconception is that, you know, and what's funny about it is if you say, hey, I'm not drinking, of course you are drinking, you're just not drinking alcohol. If you're not drinking, people kind of get this look in their eyes like they're about to ask you about your life story. It's the only thing that if you say, I'm not doing it, you have to explain yourself for. And I'd like to see that change ultimately. I'd like to see it, and it is starting to become more normalized.
If you're just joining us here on Lake Effect, I'm Audrey Nowakowski speaking with Mindy McCord of Wisconsin-based Siren Shrub Company and Derek Brown. He's an award-winning bartender and author of Mindful Mixology. You both are very ingrained in recipe building and flavor profiles. So what's the most important thing to consider when making a drink or flavor for no or low proof alcohol drinks?
I think for us, it's about balance. We believe that we've created a product that provides that balance. So it can be as simple as just splashing it into club soda or sparkling water, and you still have this really complex drink because we kind of took care of the hard part for you. But I'm sure Derek is much more well-versed in this than I am, so I will let him be the expert here.
Oh, well, shrubs are a wonderful way to make great drinks and cocktails as well. So yeah, I wrote a whole book on it called Mindful Mixology. So I think that that was kind of my question to myself before I wrote this book, is I knew kind of instinctively how to make balanced non-alcoholic cocktails, but I didn't know how to explain it necessarily to other people. So I actually, this is a kind of rare scenario, but I went to bed with that question in my head, and I woke up the next morning and I had the answer. I started to think about the different sensory components of a cocktail. And to me, you know, a big part of it was intensity of flavor, right? A cocktail is something that when you drink it, you know you're drinking a cocktail. It's not hidden in any way. So the flavor is very intense. Shrubs obviously are also can be very intense. It is something that has a certain texture. You know, it's weightier. When you're drinking it, it feels, you know, more substantial than water for sure. And it has a certain piquancy or bite. That's that bite when you take a shot of tequila or whiskey that, you know, you slam your fist on the table. That is a part of cocktails. And then lastly, there's a certain volume that is taken up by the alcohol, usually in a cocktail. And so I think adjusting for those four things, you can really do a lot. A Tom Collins without gin is just lemonade, right? So you don't want to serve just lemonade. But if you add apple cider vinegar to it, you add aquafaba, which is a chickpea water, you add a little salt, and you add some ginger syrup, all of a sudden you're kind of building the sensory components that make up a cocktail. You know, it's got more texture, more bite. That's a lot of what I try to do in my book. But you can also just buy a product nowadays, which is kind of cool, right? You can get these shrubs, or you can also get Spiritless, who has two different products. And I'm the director of education, so, you know, plug here. There's Jalisco 55, which is a tequila alternative. And there is Kentucky 74, which is a bourbon alternative. So those kind of almost go one-to-one in your bourbon or tequila cocktail. So there's lots of options, which is great news. You know, you can either do it, you know, buy my book or experiment on your own, get shrubs or get these non-alcoholic spirits. And so I think that it's a good time to be somebody who is drinking non-alcoholic cocktails.
So before the book you just mentioned, you also wrote a book on how the cocktail conquered the world. And now that you're an advocate of non-alcoholic cocktails and the sober curious movement, I'm wondering what's been your perspective of this journey as someone deeply ingrained in the cocktail bar culture and scene?
Well, there are 9 chapters to my first book. So I think of mindful mixology as my 10th chapter. I think, like I mentioned earlier, it's always been part of bartending to have no and low alcohol cocktails. That is not something new. And it should be, it's not always, but it should be part of bartending to take care of your guests and make sure that they have an array of options, but they're also safe and healthy as much as you can intervene in that area. So I think that for me at first, because I stopped drinking and I was, I had this kind of fear that, oh my gosh, you know, like I've been telling people to drink all of these great cocktails all along, what am I gonna do? And when I realized, no, these actually fit together very well. You know, it's about choice, right? Like I love cocktails in all their different forms, but I want choices when I'm drinking, and especially ones that are delicious and not afterthoughts, you know? So I think that, you know, it was a little scary for me at first to broach this topic, and I was afraid how people would respond, but I've gotten a lot of support. A lot of people who drink and don't drink alcohol have reached out for recipes or to thank me or what have you. And so I feel like this is something that is helpful to a large array of people, and I'm grateful to be a part of that.
Mindy, you started sampling out Siren Shrubs to people like at farmers markets, other local things, but both you and Derek will be part of the Drink Mindful Milwaukee event. And for anyone who's not experienced a mindful cocktail hour, what can they expect?
Yeah, so it's going to be a really cool event. So it's a collaboration with Siren Shrub Co. and Derek, as well as Waterford Wine and Spirits, where the event will take place. So there's going to be distributor partners, restaurant partners, mixologist partners. It's kind of like all the worlds colliding together in support of mindful mixology. So I think that's super awesome to get everybody on board and to start spreading the message in that way, because it does touch on all those levels. Lane and I always joke that we're trying to like scoot out the plastic red cup and straw versus a beautiful garnished cocktail. We would like both drinks to look the same as they're served to people. So we think we need the help of our distributors and our restaurant and venue partners to do this. And so at Mindful Mixology, you can expect a low and no cocktail competition with local Milwaukee restaurants and mixologists who have developed recipes. And there will be a competition with a prize sponsored by Spiritless. And then Derek will be speaking too about mindful mixology. So it should be a lot of fun. And tickets are only $10. So I highly support and suggest people go out and grab one while they can.
So Milwaukee, Madison, Wisconsin overall, we're frequently on lists of states that consume the most alcohol, binge drink. We definitely have a bar-centered culture here. Does the brewing state have a good potential to be a mindful drinking one? Like, what have you both observed? And Mindy, I'd love to start with you because you're a Wisconsin native and you're trying to, you know, foster this kind of culture and community right here, right now.
Yeah. So I feel like I want to shout from the rooftops yes to that question. Yes, there is so much potential. There is a lot of people doing the work. And like Sans Spirit, the Great Northern Distillery, it just came out with like a juniper gin type non-alcoholic beverage. There's Untitled Art, who does a bunch of NA beers. There's a lot, Top Note Tonic. I could go on. I know I'm missing people. There's a lot of people in the beverage world that are pushing towards and looking at the trends, and the market is telling us that people want this and they will pay the high price for it. It's time. And I think that we are maybe a little slower than our surrounding states to get there, but we're going to get there. And I'm excited to be a part of it.
Derek, what have you observed as your work has taken you across the U.S.? What does either Wisconsin or the Midwest in general stand out to you for?
Well, what's interesting is I was invited to New York, I was invited to L.A., and I was invited to Milwaukee of late. So I feel like, you know, sometimes people think of Milwaukee, they don't necessarily think of it as a, you know, cocktail forward sort of city, even though there's lots of drinking. But I've just seen lots of great bartenders there, lots of great bars and events like this that are you know, once old but also cutting edge, and I think that's really great. So Milwaukee in this way is leading the charge, so that's really cool. And I've got to thank Pat Miller, who organized this whole thing, because I'm really excited to go, and I'm excited to meet everybody there and to talk about my book and everything mixology, especially mindful mixology.
Well, Derek Brown and Mindy McCord, thank you both so much for joining me today.
Thank you.
Mindy McCord is the co-founder of Siren Shrub Company, and Derek Brown is the director of education for Spiritless and the author of Mindful Mixology, a comprehensive guide to no and low alcohol cocktails. They'll both be a part of the Mindful Drinking Milwaukee event this evening at Waterford Wine and Spirits, followed by a week of local restaurants featuring no and low-proof drink menus. You can find more information at WUWM.com. And in case you didn't know, you can listen to Lake Effect as a podcast. If you'd like to take us on the go or hear any of the segments on the show, search for Lake Effect in Apple Podcasts, Google Play, or wherever you get your podcasts to listen on demand. You can also follow WUWM on Instagram, where you'll find videos and pictures from news stories and Lake Effect interviews. Coming up, we'll learn about a road linking Lake Park to the lakefront that's been there for more than a century. We'll learn more next on Lake Effect on 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. This is Lake Effect on 89.7 WUWM. I'm Joy Powers. It's Monday, and that means it's time for Bubbler Talk, where we answer your questions about Milwaukee. This week, WUWM's Susan Benz explores a short, winding road on Milwaukee's east side that holds a special meaning for one of our listeners.
Bubbler Talk, quenching Milwaukee's thirst for knowledge.
The scene is Lake Park, perched above Lake Michigan on Milwaukee's east side. What you hear is the more than century-old pedestrian bridge being reconstructed.
All the railing was removed and is being put back in place. All the actual deck that you walk on, the concrete deck, was ripped out, and it's being replaced with prefabricated concrete panels that are set in place.
That's Paul Montalto. As Milwaukee County's managing engineer for field operations, he stops by every day to check on the crew's progress.
I think the uniqueness is it's originally constructed in early 1900s, and it was one of the first reinforced concrete bridges in Wisconsin.
But it's not the bridge Bubbler Talk listener Adrian LaRosa asked about. It's Ravine Road that weaves beneath it, winding through the lush wooded landscape.
This lovely winding road has been closed for so many years, and as I drive past it, I see all this equipment sitting there and a big fence, and nobody seems to be doing anything with it. So I wanted to know what's going to happen to that road and if we will ever see it opened again.
The road has been closed since 2014. LaRosa not only grew up nearby, the road holds even deeper significance for her family.
My great-uncle, Isidore Sorcy,
lovingly remembered as Uncle Izzy,
was a Golden Gloves champion,
a highly regarded amateur boxing tournament. LaRosa says Ravine Road was part of her great-uncle's training regime.
He would jog up and down that road, and so I got to know it because of him, so it kind of has family ties to me, too.
Now an unwelcoming chain-link fence with a sign reading, "No Outlet, Trail Closed," blocks the road. According to Milwaukee County Parks, the pedestrian bridge above will reopen sometime this fall, but the future of the road beneath has yet to be decided. To get some concrete intel, we travel to Alaska, not literally, by cell phone. That's where I reach Colleen Riley on holiday. Riley is a member of the Lake Park Friends Group and was president when the Ravine Bridge's future was on shaky ground.
The county had originally planned to demolish the bridge.
And as a safety precaution, decided to block the road beneath.
At that time, the county was concerned chunks of concrete were going to start falling down from the bridge.
That was 8 years ago. Riley says the Friends mobilized, first around the proposed bridge demo.
That didn't sit well with folks who really were passionate about historic preservation.
The Friends raised money to bring on a consultant to review reports that the bridge was unstable. To make a very long story short, the bridge was found to be structurally sound.
There were components that certainly needed to be reinforced, but the main structural support, which is the arch, was in very good shape.
The Friends worked with Milwaukee County to come up with funds to refurbish the bridge. In addition, the group raised $300,000 for its long-term maintenance. Happy ending, right? But what about the road beneath it? There's a bit of irony to that story. Riley says nobody debated its use until it was shut down in 2014.
Even though there were barriers up, people started to walk around those and walk down the road and realize they really enjoyed that path.
Riley says debate sprang up within the Friends group.
There were and are Lake Park Friends members who love the idea of having that be a walking path permanently, and there are others that love the idea of being able to drive it again.
But as an organization grounded in historic preservation, Lake Park Friends dug into the road's original intent. That's where Paul Daniel Marriott came in.
Professor of Landscape Architecture at the Pennsylvania State University.
Marriott knows a lot about distinguished landscape architect Frederick Law Olmsted, who designed Lake Park and other famous green spaces, including New York Central Park.
People tend to think of parks as green spaces, trees, lawns. What's important to remember, especially with the Olmsted legacy, is the importance of how you move through the park, how you experience the park.
That includes Lake Park's Ravine Road.
It's not just a random road in the park. It was a road that was very carefully designed and choreographed to showcase the landscape features, the topography, which is quite dramatic there.
Marriott calls the road a beautiful example of engineering and landscape architecture, originally designed for pleasure driving.
And carriages or early automobiles that were designed for touring. And the experience of moving through the landscape, seeing it go by, the dramatic idea of the ravine, the beautiful bridge up above, you get all these different perspectives of the park.
Marriott believes it will likely take another push from the likes of Lake Park Friends to bring Ravine Road back to life.
It could be a one-way road rather than a two-way road. It could be open for vehicles during certain hours, or it could become a part of the pedestrian system. There's lots of ways to approach this. I think that's what the Friends Group has done very effectively with Lake Park, is having a larger vision.
No matter what, Marriott says the road and its original footprint must remain.
That's part of the Olmsted legacy. So the width of the road, the surface of the road, how it moves through the landscape, that needs to be maintained.
Adrian LaRosa says that would be her Uncle Izzy's wish too.
Support for Bubbler Talk comes from Landmark Credit Union. Got a question about the Milwaukee area? Submit it at wuwm.com/bubblertalk.
Our Bubbler Talk series airs every Monday on Lake Effect. If you have a question that you'd like to submit, you can do that at WUWM.com. There you can also hear our other Bubbler Talk segments, including an explanation of where the lion statues at the Zeidler Building came from. And that wraps up today's show. Thank you so much for being here with us. I'm Joy Powers. If you missed any of today's conversations, or if you'd like to take Lake Effect on the go, you can download our podcast. Search for Lake Effect in Apple Podcasts, Google Play, or wherever you get your podcasts to listen to all of our shows on demand. Tomorrow on Lake Effect, we'll look at the importance of civility and how it can be achieved through building better relationships. Plus, we'll look at a documentary that explores how three strangers in Milwaukee became connected through a weekend of gun violence. All of that is tomorrow at noon, right here on Lake Effect, on listener-supported 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR.